Hello everyone, and welcome to 4Panel, your weekly guide to the weird and wild world of comics. I'm your host, Andrew, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Rob.
Hello!
So, Rob, how are we doing today?
Well, we are Mikolas again.
We are indeed. He is still studying away in his... I was going to say hole, but that's...
In his study.
Yeah, that's better. That's the route we probably want to go down.
I've also realised that when I say we are Mikolas, it does sound like an insult, doesn't it?
It does. It also makes it sound like we're some weird hive mind entity.
I thought we weren't going with that.
No, we had. I was maybe making reference before the show to certain online comic book groups that I'm part of and Rob is not allowed to join.
Yes.
He was cast out from the golden heavens.
Yes, because of manga. The devil form of comics.
Yeah. You'll not peddle your mangoes here.
But mangoes are so tasty.
Yeah, this is yet another Andrew is a little bit ill and so is maybe slightly loopy week.
Yeah. Andrew has Lemsip brain, as Rob calls it. Not this Rob, the other Rob.
So you're not referring to yourself in the third person yet.
I've just realised I did that. Move on. Just, yeah. Actually, it is kind of relevant, isn't it?
It is relevant. Because speaking of kind of omnipresent third-person narrators, this week we are going to be talking about comic book tropes that are kind of either died out or aren't as much in use as they once were.
Yeah.
And I think that is definitely a very good example of one that's just kind of completely died to death.
Yeah, the narrator.
Yeah, specifically the idea of, like, a narrator who is not just one of the characters.
Or the Watcher.
So the Watcher's not a character.
No, well...
You don't know what he gets up to, Rob. You don't know what he's like when he's having a cheeky one with the lads.
I'm assuming that he is quite a character. I mean, I've read plenty of stuff where the Watchers have kind of gone off the rails and then had to be exiled and... of being a bit too rambunctious. Rambunctious Watchers, that's a thing, isn't it?
I would absolutely watch, like, The Hangover, but with Watchers.
It'd be amazing. One of the Watchers with, like, a diamond tooth. The other one with a face tattoo.
One of them's literally just wearing a nappy.
Oh, hell. Oh, Weekend at Bernie's with Watchers.
But yeah, but the narrator thing, it's interesting. Because it's one of those things where over the decades, kind of the way comic book stories have been told, like, has changed a lot.
Yeah. It was very third person for a long time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It's interesting because I'm not really... A lot of these ones, I can kind of sort of maybe point to something and go, yeah, I bet this is why it's changed. But this just seems to be one of those things where kind of storytelling conventions in general have altered.
Well, I think it started happening during the 70s. It started moving away from third person to, well, not a first person perspective, but more of a standard narrative perspective, you know, as if you were reading a book or something like that. So,
yeah, maybe. But then, I mean, you have Chris Claremont, who, you know, he literally has a trope named after him, the angry Claremontian narrator.
Yeah. Thing is, I'm not saying it died out. I'm saying it started moving away from the kind of the narrator type narrative to a more standard storybook narrative. But we didn't really see the culmination of that until more recently. So you had like this decades long, 20, 25, 30 years long transition from the old way to the new way.
Yeah, I think so. Also, actually looking at it, I think it maybe ties into something else I've got down on my list. In that we don't really get kind of thought bubbles anymore.
Yeah, that's...
So you won't really have a character literally just say, these are my thoughts that I am thinking right now.
That's a thing that I miss.
So I think what it probably is maybe this idea that, like, as comic books have kind of matured as a medium.
Yeah.
It's, you kind of, you want to tell your stories in ways that are not just a character or a narrator saying, this is the thing that is happening now, you know, because I am telling you.
Yes. I used to like the thought bubbles. I used to like the whole idea of knowing what the character was thinking when I was little. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I think it
was a very juvenile way of approaching storytelling.
But I think it's the kind of thing where I'm probably glad it doesn't happen now.
Yeah.
But I do kind of have a soft spot for it in older comics.
Yes. I mean, if they put it into modern comics, you'd go, what the hell are you doing? But if you pick up something from like 30, 40 years ago, you go, ah.
That's kind of, it's the nostalgia of that kind of sort of pulpy adventure feel.
It's not just that, it goes with the art style as well, doesn't it? You couldn't have a modern comic with thought bubbles and have it be palatable. It would have to be done in a very, very old school way, or a very, I don't know, a very children's storybook way.
Yeah. I think also it's cool that it kind of shows writers and editors sort of putting more trust in the art to convey what a character's thinking.
Yeah. It was that age-old thing, actions speak louder than words. Picture paints 1,000 words.
Yeah, exactly. Also, speaking of things that we're nostalgic for, I think one of my favourite tropes that's pretty much just entirely disappeared is along the similar veins of this. Just characters going into, like, expository dialogue.
Oh, I love that. I
love the idea that Spider-Man's just swinging about the city, kind of just recounting to himself the most important events of the last week.
Exactly. So, on Monday, I had dinner with Aunt May. Maybe not in that voice. That was my attempt to be suave.
I just love the phrase, like, wait a second, that's Mysterio. The man who I fought recently and discovered was illusionist Quentin Beck. did you, like, forget Spider-Man and just have to remind yourself?
Does he have one of those? Do you remember the Filofaxes? Maybe he had a Filofax, a spider Filofax, a spider fax.
No, he has the special Deadpool supervillain cards.
Yes. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Oh, no, because they work with the Filofax. Because the Filofax had reference cards, didn't it? Oh, a special Deadpool version of a Filofax. I want one now. Actually, I really want a Deadpool Filofax.
I'm sure they could make one, except for the fact that literally no one on the planet uses a Filofax.
Hey, every Deadpool fan would want a Deadpool Filofax with special Deadpool reference cards. And its own special Deadpool calculator, special Deadpool pen, special Deadpool calendar, special Deadpool notebook, with pithy comments from Deadpool on certain pages. Am I pushing this marketing thing a bit too hard?
I think you might be. I know. Rob, I know we discussed about how we don't really do a lot of marketing type stuff. You may be swerving in too much in the direction.
All I'm saying is that for Deadpool 3, I could very much see them just here is a bunch of random crap that we decided to come up with just for promotion.
Definitely ends with you just like running around the streets with a bunch of Deadpool stickers slapping on things and screaming, Deadpool branded lamppost, Deadpool branded pavement, Deadpool branded dog.
See, you say me, but you actually mean you, since you have all of the stickers.
Man, I do have all the stickers. But once again, I apologise to everyone else in the world because I have all the stickers and so they can have none.
And as we established a long time ago, he who has all the stickers is king.
I feel like that's demonstrably untrue, though.
I have to tell them we lie sometimes.
I think of it as entertainingly fudge the truth.
Yeah, creative storytelling. That's another thing that I miss from comic books.
Boo. Boo, Rob. Yeah, so I think the thing we can talk about, because this is sort of, I think what got us thinking about this whole topic initially was a little while back when we were doing that Winter Soldier miniseries.
Yes.
And just kind of hit upon the idea that you don't really have sidekicks anymore.
Yes, that's a big thing.
If anything, it's really weird because I feel like sidekicks are kind of one of those things that are like sort of a pillar of people's like general conceptions of superheroes. But if you think about it, they've been kind of decreasing for decades now.
Yeah.
Certainly, if you look at like the heroes of the 40s and 50s, it was pretty much mandatory that every superhero had a sidekick. But I mean, from the 60s onwards, they've kind of been rapidly decreasing.
That's generally the case with comic books across the board. I mean, I think was Image had a comic book series called Sidekicks?
Yeah, I think that was Image.
But in general, with Marvel and DC, I mean, obviously Batman still has Robin, but Batman and Robin have been a thing for decades, so I don't think they're going to remove that.
I think that's maybe why Sidekicks are still like an enduring part of the mythos. Yeah. Because Batman's such a prominent hero and like Robin is such a prominent part of his stories.
Yeah, because I mean, with Batman, you've got Robin, but then you've got Batgirl as well, is also technically a sidekick initially. When you think about it, there's a lot of sidekicks. I mean, if you look in the MCU, technically Bucky Barnes and Falcon are Captain America's sidekicks.
Yeah, I feel like Falcon, though, is one of those ones where kind of... Actually, I guess that's a lot of the thing, is it's not that superheroes don't have people they work with. It's the kind of that line between sort of sidekick and just like a partner's blurred a lot more.
Yeah, because, I mean, sidekicks are characters like Jimmy Olsen.
Yeah, this is very kind of very specifically sort of peppy teen is like a junior version of that hero and follows on their every word.
Oh, so you're on about like Speedy for Green Arrow.
Yeah, except like your Speedies, your Robins, your Kid Flashes, your Wonder Girl. Basically the lineup of the original Teen Titans.
Yeah. With Marvel, you had... Falcon was Captain America's sidekick originally in the comics, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think so, but I feel like he was very deliberately kind of like sort of an anti-sidekick.
Because Captain America
was still filling that role, but he's like, he's very specifically not the, I'm not just some like peppy teenage boy that you can order about.
Yeah, that was Bucky. Bucky was the original sidekick, but then you had others. You had like Demolition Man, or D-Man, whatever you want to call him. He had Falcon. He had Free Spirit. I didn't understand what she was about. He had Jack Flag and that annoying face cloth.
Jack Flag.
That face cloth of his.
Also, the thing with the face cloth is you get hung up on that and you kind of can't even really process the fact that he dyed his hair like the American flag.
Yeah, I know.
Imagine how long that took.
Marvel had kind of the ultimate superhero sidekick in the form of Rick Jones. And I really would be interested in seeing if in the MCU they will introduce Rick Jones at some point.
Maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's like all things in life. They just decided instead of each hero having their own separate sidekick, they just outsource it all to Rick Jones.
Well, that's basically what the comics did, wasn't it?
Pretty much.
He was Bruce Banner's sidekick and the Incredible Hulk's sidekick. He was Captain Marvel's sidekick. He was Captain America's sidekick for a time when he took over the role of Bucky.
He was. Although, weirdly, that seems to be a thing that, like, doesn't get brought up as much as I feel like it should.
Yeah, I know. It's one of those strange corners of Marvel history that people just go, oh, yeah, that happened.
Yeah. Remember that time when Captain America just walked up to a random teenage boy and was like, here, wear this outfit, come fight crime with me.
Yes.
Jump in front of the bullets, Rick.
And Rick
went... Protect my body like a shield.
Yeah, and Rick
went... Yes, I know I'm already holding a shield. But don't question my orders, young man.
And Rick went, oh, goody, I could be like Robin.
Yeah, he was.
Oh, I think I just want to bring this up, right? In terms of sidekicks, one of the best sidekick names that Marvel ever came up with was the sidekick for Marvel Man.
Was it Marvel Boy?
No, it was Kid Marvel Man.
Ooh, that's that is almost but not quite as bad as Lady Stiltman.
Exactly.
My theory is what I think probably started the death knell for sidekicks. It's actually Spider-Man.
Oh?
Because I think... So for me, the theory behind sidekicks is that, you know, you're making a comic, your primary audience is teenage boys, so you want a character that they can relate to.
Yeah.
But then Marvel come along and just say, well, what if we take that teenage character and just make them the hero? And so I feel that kind of started a shift away from, like, having a relatable teen character in another hero's book to just, you know, making them the protagonist.
Yeah, because you see that working more and more often now. More and more of the heroes have a teenage alternative, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, look at someone like Ms. Marvel.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that she's very specifically not Carol Danvers' sidekick.
Yeah, because that then leads us to Champions, who technically are a group of sidekicks, but not.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. It's very much the point that they're like, nah, forget the adults, they're a bunch of dum-dums, we're going to do what we want.
Yeah.
Anyway, shall we move on to the next thing on my list?
Could I just bring up one sidekick, though? One in particular. Because he was basically, I think in Marvel, he's probably one of my favourite sidekicks of all time. Bob, Agent of Hydra.
Oh, Bob. You. I mean, hero isn't the word, is it?
No, it's not.
Idiot Meat Shield is probably the better term.
Yes. And now you know why I wanted to mention Bob.
So the next few things on my list, I think they're not necessarily things that have completely died out, but they're certainly not the norm anymore. And it's sort of the way in which the comics themselves are structured. So you get things like there's less just sort of standalone stories. There's less sort of anthology books. So, you know, ones that'll have, you know, like just basically like what we have as 2000 AD, but not much else. There's kind of different stories in each issue. And we don't have as many companies doing sort of different genre comics.
Mm.
So like, say there was Timely Tales, that thing that Marvel did. And like, it's the kind of, you don't really see anymore. It's like, you know, romance comics or horror comics where you could just, you know, pick up the issue. Each one will have like a story in it. And then next week it's a completely different story.
Yeah.
And I think that's an interesting look at how things have become kind of more focused and more leaning into this idea that, you know, comics are about superheroes.
Yeah, it's bizarre that it took this long, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's also a shame. I'd like to see more companies kind of branching out into different things.
I don't want to see, because we've done some of the DC crossover stuff, the weird, bizarre Warner Brothers DC crossover stuff.
Yeah, but again, that's crossovers with superheroes.
Yeah, and what I'm saying is I don't want to see that kind of crossover stuff happening. If they're going to do something different, then do something different, something away from superheroes, something that you just want to do because you want to do it. Don't try and tie the superheroes into it in some way.
I guess probably the flip side of that, though, is this. The comics market is not a huge one.
No, it's not. I'm going to have to bring up manga here, but it's something that is done successfully in manga, but manga has the basis for that. It has the reputation for being able to tell all these different types of stories. So superhero stories, they're not very common in manga. Superpowered characters, you have plenty of those in manga, but actual superheroes are a rarity.
Yeah, and I guess the thing that's like helped manga is right from fairly early on, there's always been this conception of, okay, we have different markets that we're aiming at. So this book will appeal to this audience, this book will appeal to that audience.
Yeah, they did try that with comics for a long time. I mean, you had your war comics and you had your football comics and your sports comics and you had like your romance comics and stuff like that. So you had this wealth of different types of stories being told in comic book form. But for some reason, superheroes just kind of outlasted everything else.
Yeah.
And I blame television.
I mean, well, I think a lot of it's probably more as the comics market has become sort of more insular, just appealing to people who are already fans of things. And as, you know, their cost have made them more of a luxury item than just a thing you could buy with pocket money.
Damn it, you ruined my old man joke.
You're right, I did. Once again, facts have brought us nothing but disappointment.
I was leading up to what I thought, but probably wasn't, I'll give you fair warning, what I thought but probably wasn't a good old man joke. And then you ruined it with your facts.
I mean, look, it's not stopped you before. Do you want to just tell it?
I was basically going to do my best gaffer impression. Is like, oh, you young kids watching your soap operas and stuff like that.
Well, there you go, everyone. That's
and your MTV and things.
That's a thing that's been included in this episode of Four Panel.
Anyway.
You just lie back, listeners, and think of all the things we cut out of this week and decided, no, this we need to keep.
Anyway, moving on. Here's a question, because it was something that I've seen less of, and I've noticed that it's a thing in older comic books, but as time has progressed, it's become less and less of a thing. You know when superhero comics refer to, like, real-life events? Or they include celebrities, or when they do the president, but they do it as the current president?
See, the president thing, I think, is interesting, because I'm not sure it's happened that recently, but I know there's always been sort of a weird back and forth on that.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes they'll, like, mention the president, and they'll just be, like, some generic guy or, like, maybe a figure you only see in shadow.
Mm.
And then other times they're like, okay, we need to go run this by President George W. Bush or, like, President Barack Obama. Yeah. He's here with us in the studio tonight, ladies and gentlemen.
It's a bizarre thing, isn't it?
It is, and I'm not sure which one I prefer. Because obviously having, like, a specific president, you know, dates comics in ways that you then kind of just have to ignore if you want any semblance of pretending that this is, like, a coherent timeline.
Yeah, but I mean,
but then it's always so weirdly noticeable when, like, they don't mention who the president is.
Yeah, but just building on that, just expanding on that, the whole bit when they have a celebrity who's in the comic, I think you mentioned Anderson Cooper.
Oh, I did. That really weird advert for, like, when he was in Black Widow.
Yeah.
But it's not... I don't understand that as a selling point.
Do you see what I mean?
You've just drawn a person. Like, you haven't spoken to this celebrity and booked them to appear in the comic. You've just decided to draw a picture of them.
My point, exactly. But...
although it is interesting that now we seem to have moved from that to getting celebrities to write the comics instead.
Yeah, which is it's a strange thing, because...
yep, it sure is a thing that has mixed results.
Yeah, because as you know, some celebrities have difficulty writing.
Yeah, they do.
One of the things, though, that I did want to mention is that at the times when, you know, when they focus, because I mentioned the when they include real world events, there are times when it just goes horribly, horribly wrong.
Yeah, they are. I guess it's if that event, you know, kind of has some kind of follow on or, like, the perception of it changes.
Yeah.
It can then be super awkward to go back and read about them.
Yeah. Or if you've got a character who's notoriously tried to destroy the free world, crying about something in the free world being destroyed. Doctor Doom, for example.
Yeah. It's also one of those things, like, that's the kind of case where I can more appreciate the sentiment behind it than saying,
yeah,
well, this doesn't line up with the logic of the comics.
Yeah, I understand the sentiment behind it. I'm just like, but there's a part of my brain that goes, well, maybe not hissing that badly, but you know what I mean.
But yeah, I think kind of the flip side to that is if the real world event is kind of like a tragedy.
Yeah.
It's maybe a bit awkward having these, like, gaudily clad, very unsubtle heroes trying to deal with it.
Yeah.
Like, it inevitably comes across as, like, I mean, that's another thing that's fallen out of fashion. The good old school PSA comic.
Oh, God, yes. Which I love the fact that in the movies they really ridiculed those with the Captain America videos.
Yes. I think my favourite thing of that is still the Teen Titans say no to drugs, but not Robin, apparently.
Actually, there is one trope that I do want to mention, and it's a visual trope, which I'm really glad we see the back of these days. Well, it's kind of a combination of visual tropes. The really, really, really... really skin-tight spandex.
Oh, yeah, I think that kind of comes under the draw of maybe... tropes that are just a bit awkward and problematic, and it's definitely good we've seen the back of.
Yeah. I mean, just... my God. And they got away with it. They got away with it for like 10 years, man. 10 years.
I know. And apart from like the ones where it's, oh, look at this woman in what is essentially a bathing suit.
Yeah.
It's always so weird when you've got like a hero and you can see all like the muscle definition and stuff underneath the costume.
Oh, that's
like, it looks like you've just spray painted it on.
Yeah. But that's another thing that I do want to mention. The other trope that goes along with the skin-tight spandex is, see, Superman could get away with it because he's Kryptonian. Kryptonian biology is different to human biology. We know that. But what's your excuse, Mr. Bruce Wayne? Why do you have more muscles than I found on the human body? Because he did during the 90s. It was a very common problem during the 90s and early noughties. Bruce Wayne had more muscles than were found on the human body. Especially, you know that bit where it goes wider just under the armpits? Especially that area.
See, I love it because there's a podcast I like called The Magnus Archives. And it's like a horror fiction podcast. And there's a creature in that. They can like reach into human bodies and just like pull out bones and organs and things and shove them into its body. And I always like to imagine that that's what every character in the 90s did.
Mainly DC characters, ironically enough. Marvel...
mainly characters drawn by Rob Liefeld.
Rob Liefeld basically went down the route of, oh look, it's a woman, she has no waist and very large breasts. And we're going to leave it at that. Oh, it's a guy, let's cover him in pouches. Pouches everywhere.
Do you think maybe what happened is they took kind of like all the female characters, you know, like intestines and internal organs that they physically cannot sustain in that body and just sort of like glued them onto all the male characters' chests?
Possibly, or it was just that Rob Liefeld until recently could never talk about his secret corset fetish. How narrow does that waist have to be?
Another thing I feel like, definitely hasn't died a death, but is definitely taken a sharp decline. It's just the idea of secret identities.
Yes.
Which, I think seems pretty obviously, because it's like, it's one of those run-longing jokes. That's staying in as well.
Yes, it is.
It's one of those long-running jokes, you know, stuff like how do people not notice that Superman is just Clark Kent with his glasses off?
Yeah, it's pretty obvious. And I love the fact that in the Ms. Marvel comics, Kamala's mother knows that she's Ms. Marvel and has known for pretty much the entire run up to that point that her daughter is Ms. Marvel. Because it's really not that hard to tell that she's Ms. Marvel, isn't it?
Yeah. I think that's another thing, is even with the heroes who do have secret identities, there's like a much larger increase in sort of the circle of people who also know.
Yeah.
Like, there's not really any more like, oh no, I can't tell Aunt May because she'll have a scare and crumble to dust.
Was she a vampire?
Maybe. Maybe that's why Peter Parker was always so, like, afraid to tell her anything. Oh my god, what was in those wheat cakes? That's it, I've cracked the next Spider-Man movie.
Oh, I forgot about
Spider-Man 3, Curse of May's Wheat Cakes.
I forgot about the wheat cakes. It's like the dumbest... It was one of the dumbest things that Marvel ever came up with, was this thing called wheat cakes, which is a real thing and tastes bland.
Yeah, I feel like it is one of those weird things where like things haven't updated from the 60s, in that Peter Parker is like a 30-year-old millennial who for some reason eats wheat cakes.
It's because it's wholesome, goddammit. It's wholesome.
It's all about wheat cakes and hostess fruit pies.
I forgot the hostess fruit pies. Oh, shall we take a break there?
I think we should. You know, I had some other things, but they might even work as whole episodes.
Oh, all right. Okay.
So there's a tantalizing, dangling hook for listeners.
Right, okay, we'll be back soon.
Hi, this is Krillin. And this is Usopp. And you're listening to The Geek Show.
Have you ever been reading through a stack of comics and thought, maybe I should see what this Arkham Asylum game is all about? Or been playing Marvel vs. Capcom and felt like you were at a real disadvantage since you didn't know who half the characters were? Well, Play Comics is the show for you. I'm Chris, and each episode we take a look at video games based on comic properties and how well they stick to that source material. So whether you know the comics and want to know how all these games work, or you know the games and want to find out where all this craziness came from, go check out Play Comics at playcomics.com or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
And welcome back to the show. Now we're going to be talking about what we've been reading. So, Rob, do you want to kick things off? No, you don't, because before you do, I should say a big thank you, as I often forget to do, to Turnaround Books, who provide all our review copies of stuff.
Yes, thank you.
So, you know, once again, thank you a lot. We pretty much couldn't do the show without you guys.
Yes, thank you very much, Turnaround Publishing Services. We love you, but you love us sometimes a bit too much. We're not getting into that again. Anyway.
No, it's fine.
Anyway, we've got, Wolverine, more Wolverine. I had Wolverine last week, but now I've got Wolverine again. I seem to be having a bad case of Wolverine. I will see a doctor about it soon, don't worry. Anyway, this is Wolverine, The Long Night, and it's written by Benjamin Percy, with art by Marcio Takara, colours by Matt Miller, letters by VC's Joe Caramagna, who literally gets everywhere, cover art by Rafael Albuquerque. And this collects Wolverine The Long Night adaptation numbers 1-5. This is based on Marvel's hit scripted podcast, which apparently comes to life on the printed page.
Can we just take a quick sidebar to mention that it is kind of weird that Marvel have made a comic of the podcast based on a comic book property?
Yeah.
I love stuff like that.
Yeah, it is. We haven't quite reached the critical levels of meta yet, but we are getting there.
Nothing is Street Fighter the movie, the video game.
Yeah, I know. That's what I was about to mention. Nothing has reached that point yet, but we are getting there. We are heading into that territory, and I reckon Deadpool's going to do it at some point. You know that Deadpool's going to do. Deadpool, the movie, the video game, of the podcast, of the book, of the play.
Of the comic. Oh, wow. You know, I'm surprised they haven't done something like that already.
I know. In terms of movies, I know somebody who has been that meta on more than one occasion, and that is Mel Brooks in movies like Spaceballs and Blazing Saddles. This has been a public service announcement from The Geek Show. Anyway, back to Wolverine The Long Night. This basically follows Special Agent Tad Marshall and Special Agent Sally Pierce, who are special agents in... Well,
really? Are they?
Thing is, they're special agents, but it doesn't really say who they're special agents for.
It was just like the CIA's new special morale building exercise.
Well, they're very Mulder and Scully type special agents. You know, they're going around trying to solve these mysteries because the truth is apparently out there, and they're trying to track down the truth about Logan, who was last seen on a fishing vessel somewhere in Alaska, and they're going through and following and following and following Logan's trail. Right, you know in Man of Steel, the Zack Snyder movie, Man of Steel?
I'm inherently wary because you've mentioned it, but yeah.
You know that whole bit where Lois Lane is following Superman's trail through the things that he's done, you know, all the good deeds and stuff like that? Yeah?
Yeah, because he's got soul, but he's not a soldier.
Yeah. Well, this is kind of like that. These two special agents are following Wolverine's trail through the things that he's done. But really, Wolverine just wants to be left alone as usual. But he's in an area where the rich guy in the area apparently has a secret, and that secret can't be told. It's a secret never to be told because it's a dark, dark secret, and Wolverine is somehow involved in this, and people are dying left, right, and centre. People are getting their heads cut off, and there's a religious cult, and yada, yada, yada. And it's all very, very X-Files. It's like Marvel looked at the X-Files and said, we should do a podcast about the X-Files, but let's include comic book heroes like Wolverine, because that would be good. And someone said, yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. So they did the comic book podcast, and that was probably a lot of fun. But then they did the comic book version of that podcast, which sadly wasn't as much fun.
Oh, was it? Because I was going to say that, like, as much as I've been kind of poking fun at it a bit, that setup did sound like a really cool story.
Thing is, the story itself, if it's done as kind of a narrated story in terms of a podcast, I can see it working. But the problem is, when you transpose the structure of that sort of story to the page, you have to change certain elements of it so that the story continues to make sense. It's like the difference between a movie and a play, you know?
Yeah.
It's a subtle difference, but it is there. Because a movie could
probably even worse, because you're going from like an entirely audio-based medium to an entirely visual-based one.
Exactly. Because there are certain... the way people say things, the way people explain things, it adds an immediacy to the way you actually ingest that narrative. I use the word ingest that narrative. I love that phrase, by the way. Ingest the narrative.
Wow. But, that is maybe going on the special four-panel board.
But yeah, it basically adds an immediacy. It adds a lot of emotional depth to it, the way that things are said. And that comes through when you listen to the podcast version. But when you're just reading it on a page, it doesn't have that same immediacy. It doesn't have that same tension. And the art style, the bizarre thing is, in general, the art style isn't bad. It's very scratchy in places. It's very kind of rough around the edges. And it works to a degree, but then there are times when it's a bit too simplistic, where one of the characters, literally, his face is like 6 or 7 lines, make up his face. That's it.
Huh.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, it sounds weird.
It is a bit weird. I mean, it plays out like you'd expect an X-Files story to play out, with everybody just kind of going, I don't know what's going on, and then, you know, there's a big fight with stuff. It ends in a way that I didn't quite like the ending. I just thought, okay, you've got people just doing their jobs. Why are you punishing them for just doing their jobs? Do you see what I mean?
Okay.
But, yeah, Wolverine, The Long Night, as a podcast, because I have listened to the podcast version, and as a podcast, it works. But as a comic book, it's lacking.
Okay, well, sure, you can answer the very important question that I have.
Mm-hmm.
In the podcast, the actor who plays Wolverine, when he pops his claws, does he just say the word snicked?
I am not going to tell you. That's something you have to discover yourself.
I feel like we've had many a conversation on doing things and my dislike of it. But anyway, keeping the disappointment train rolling, I've been reading From the World of Hellboy, Crimson Lotus, by John Arcudi, with art by Mindy Lee, colours by Michelle Madsen, and letters by Clem Robbins, based on the character created by Guy Davis and John Arcudi. So this is the point where the Hellboy spin-offs are getting a tad ridiculous.
Okay.
This is a story about Crimson Lotus, a villain for Lobster Johnson.
What?
So it's a spin-off of a spin-off. So yeah, Crimson Lotus, she is a young Japanese girl at the time of the Russo-Japanese War, so the early 1900s, which is a thing I can pretend I know and didn't just look up in the book. So yeah, basically, her father is killed by Grigory Rasputin while he's stealing some kind of ancient stone artifact type thing. And we then cut to several years later, two secret agents of the Chinese government, agents Dai and Sheng Li. They are, you know, on the trail of the Crimson Lotus, trying to figure out what she wants and how to stop her from doing all her evil machinations that she has. And it's so there are some parts of the book I like. Like, it starts off pretty strong with kind of being this big mystery about, you know, who's the Crimson Lotus? What's she up to? We've got to have, you know, this kind of clandestine meeting with one of our agents on a train, but oh no, assassins have broken on, and now we've got to do the classic, you know, fight through the aisles, gonna have a bit of a tussle on the train rooftop.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's your fun kind of James Bond-esque mixed with a, I mean, this note is very heavily inspired by like old Chinese movie serials. So that bit's fun. But I feel like the problem is once Crimson Lotus herself becomes involved in the plot, because she's basically, she's a witch, and it becomes a lot of, oh, she's found us, how has she done that? Magic.
Okay.
Just, we're going to get away from her, we've almost escaped, but what's up? Nope, magic again. And it feels like it's the first two issues of this set up a lot of mystery plot that's then immediately just kind of choked to one side to become a far less interesting, oh, here's a bunch of characters who can do magic, and they're just going to do like kind of whatever the plot demands. And I think it also doesn't help. I think this is a problem that's definitely becoming more and more apparent with these kind of books, where it's just the story itself doesn't really have much in the way of a satisfying conclusion. It's just setting up things that are expanded on in other books. But there's not really anything here that makes you go, oh, this, you know, this ties into like one of the main Hellboy stories, and I'm maybe having your appreciation for that. Like, it's a story we didn't really need to know. I think it also doesn't help that, I mean, you know, you're not really reading it for the plot. The action's kind of mostly fine. I think the art as well, I did not like it at all. It's got in places, it looks a bit too cartoony and a bit, there's almost parts where there's, especially like at the start when Crimson Lotus is a child, where it looks a little bit like, you know, 90s comics trying to do a manga.
Yeah.
You know, with the very big heads, the ridiculously huge eyes that are like the size of 2/3 of the face. That's not a good look. And it feels like the inks and colours are very, very clean and glossy. And I feel like that doesn't gel with the kind of sort of grimmer, more dingy world of Hellboy. Which again is I think a problem with some of the magic in this. There's lots of it seems like very big and showy. Like people kind of like blasting bolts of energy at each other. Which is sort of, it's very Doctor Strange, and just again it doesn't makes it feel like it's not a Hellboy reverse story. Yeah, Crimson Lotus. It's not very good, to be honest.
Yeah, it doesn't sound very entertaining. Speaking of things that don't sound very entertaining, and, well, the first volume wasn't for Mick. This is I'm Standing on a Million Lives, Volume 2, which is a manga by Akinari Nao, but it's actually an adaptation of the light novel story by Naoki Yamakawa. And this continues the adventures of the three characters, Yatsuya and his two school friends and one more person, in a different world, which they've been transported to by that god who has hands for nipples and a star for a crotch.
Oh, now I remember which one this is.
Yeah, this is that one. Now, here's the thing. They can't really die unless all of them die. They'll get revived as long as one of them stays alive. And there is a certain game-like element to this entire world structure. But in very much the same way as the first story, it's very hard to like any of the characters, especially the main male character, Yotsuya. He is not a nice character at all, but I think he's designed that way. I think he's meant to be unlikable. I think he's meant to be this character who is really, really practical and pragmatic to the point where you hate him for being practical and pragmatic. You know the type of character I'm on about. Someone who basically just looks at the most efficient solution and tries to do that regardless of the cost or the consequences.
Yeah, the kind of oh man, I want to like say a serious example, but all I can think of is Dwight from The Office.
Yeah, basically Dwight from The Office. But in this scenario, Yotsuya, basically he has his classmates who like him for some reason, and he kind of likes them, so he feels a little bit responsible for them, and they're in this other world together, so he has to try and change how he does things. It tries to portray him as evil by nature, neutral evil, the lawful evil, rather than the chaotic evil.
Oh, it must be lawful evil.
Yeah. The thing that annoys me a little bit about this is the art style's not bad, but they really could have done more work with the backgrounds. The character designs and the monster designs aren't bad, but in general, it's just not a gripping story. I'll be honest, right? I read this manga a while ago, originally, and when I read through Volume 2 again, right, there are sections of this where I went, when did that happen? Because I honestly could not remember those sections on my first reading through the manga a while ago, I'll admit, but on my first reading, I couldn't remember them. So I'm sitting there going, I do not remember this section of this story. When did they do this section of the story? Why don't I remember this? When did they fight this monster? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, well, I think it's a thing you've mentioned a lot in the past, isn't it? That this transported to another world genre. There's so many manga about it.
This one was unusual because of the character who takes them to this other world, but also the fact that it's more like the school bus to another world or the shuttle service to another world. They go there to another world, do a mission, and then go back home. You see what I mean?
Okay. Yeah, but I'm sure it's like quite easy for things to get blurred together and you can't really remember, oh, which one was this one again?
Yeah, it is. It really is, especially as this is stepping into seinen territory or the more mature territory, but it really is dyed-in-the-wool shonen manga stuff. This is for a teenage audience, and the reason I say that is because this is for all those people who like characters like Lelouch Lamprouge from Code Geass or Light Yagami from Death Note. The guys who stand there with one hand or covering half their face going, I will control the world! This is a manga for people who like those sorts of characters. So it seems like disappointments all round, and equally disappointing are the things that happened afterwards.
To let listeners in on our little trade secret.
Yeah.
It's now actually the day after we started recording the show.
Yes, technical issues. Well, you know how they say everything's on fire? In a metaphysical sense, it was. It was an imaginary fire that burned our souls, Andrew.
I mean, I'm going to have to take your word for it, because Zencaster wouldn't let me in to see the fire.
Wouldn't let you into heaven. Kept you at the gates. Saying, no trainers.
And then, you know, I'd go away, I'd stick a fake moustache on, change my shirt, come back again. It was like, nope, nice try. You're back out again.
Oh, God, I've got like a... You know, all the angels is like bouncers, you know, with the bomber jackets and the wings. If your name's not on the list, you're not coming in.
I mean, that's it. We've finally solved all religious debates.
Heaven is just one giant nightclub. Oh, right. Anyway, we do have to finish. So, Andrew, what have we got to finish?
So, I am finally going to tell our listeners about Jiro Taniguchi's Skyhawk.
Ooh.
The manga Zencaster doesn't want you to know about.
And I'm going to fake surprise that I've never heard of this before. Oh, I've wanted to know about this.
Yes. Well, Rob, I'm sure you'll be very surprised to know that the plot involves two Japanese samurai who were around in the Boshin War in the early 18th. Good God, I've had an entire evening where I could have researched what the Boshin War actually is, and I didn't. Anyway, our two protagonists are Hiko Saburo and Manzo, and basically they were on the losing side in a Japanese war, and so were exiled from their country and had to kind of hop on a boat to America, where they've been trying to scrape together a living ever since.
So, samurai in America, it's an unusual story. I'm not saying there weren't samurai in America, but in the 1800s?
Well, I mean, it's something I didn't realize until I actually got to the sort of author's notes at the back. That was actually a real thing that happened.
Really?
There were a bunch of samurai who just kind of up sticks and moved to America.
Wow.
See, we're learning things.
Mm.
So the manga begins with our two samurai kind of down on their luck. They've lost pretty much all their money, and now they're just stuck squatting in a cabin in the woods while Manzo kind of tries to heal from a bear attack.
Is this the kind of cabin where, you know, there's a secret organization in the basement?
No, there's not like a bunch of mysterious artifacts that if you pick one, a government employee will, you know, fill out a form to release the correct monster.
All right, okay. Just checking.
Yeah. But then one day while Hiko is out hunting, he comes across a Native American woman who's just given birth. So he takes her back to the cabin where they discover she's actually an escaped slave from a local trading post. So they end up kind of taking her to a local tribe who help them defend against, you know, the traders. And they end up kind of living with and eventually joining this tribe of Native Americans.
Cool.
Yeah, it's really cool because I like what puts it above something like, say, Dances with Wolves.
Yeah.
Is that it's not so much, wow, I'm going to learn how to be the best Native American, even better than all the other actual Native Americans.
Oh, so it's also not like, what was it, The Last Samurai and Brotherhood of the Wolf, where a Frenchman decides he's going to become part of the Native Americans, but also be better than Native Americans because the Native American who was trained and born and raised in the tribe has lesser skills somehow than the Frenchman.
Yeah, but yeah, no, this is much more about kind of an exchange of cultures. So, you know, so kind of the Native Americans can, you know, show the samurai, you know, this is our way of life, this is what we're doing. And then the samurai can be like, you know, this is Bushido, this is our warrior's code. It's, do you know what it reminds me of? And this is not the comparison I made in an earlier review.
Oh.
But it's very similar to like a Seven Samurai.
Ah. Well, that's interesting.
It's this very, you know, we've thrown in with this people and therefore we will now fight to defend them.
Okay, yeah, I see. I get it, yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting because it's one of those things. Obviously, I know it's a big thing in Japan that a lot of, you know, a lot of their films can be inspired by Westerns, and then a lot of Westerns were kind of inspired by samurai films.
Yeah.
So it makes a lot of sense that, you know, these two cultures have a lot in common and actually get on very well with each other. But anyway, I like this manga a lot because it's like, it's very bittersweet.
Because
It's, you know, it's kind of about our main characters kind of finding a modicum of peace, but also in a world where, like, they've kind of gone from one dying culture to another.
Mm.
And a lot of it's, I think they make a good choice to end the manga at the Battle of the Little Bighorn.
Ooh, that's,
Yeah, I think it works. Because obviously that's kind of one of the biggest Native American victories. So it's nice to kind of end the story proper on that point. And then you can kind of have the epilogue about how, you know, eventually the US government did manage to drive the Native Americans off into reservations. And actually, I'm going to spoil it a little bit just to say that it does kind of end on this really nice note of sort of Hiko and Manzo just taking a bunch of, you know, the remaining Native Americans and sort of riding off into the Canadian wilderness, never to be seen again.
See, I like that. And the thing is, that's how, you know, all those classic Westerns ended, you know, with them riding off into the sunset.
Exactly. And yeah, this has got, I just want to call it cinematography rather than art.
That's the thing about Jiro Taniguchi's work. He's really good at framing. He's really good at seeing how he wants each panel to be.
Yeah, and like you can clearly tell in some of the panels where it's like very heavily influenced by various Westerns and samurai films.
Yeah.
Like there's a great bit where kind of some of the traders capture running deer again and they're just camping out.
Mm.
And then you just see Hiko like running out of the shadows towards the fire. It also does a really cool thing where you never actually see him, like, slice anyone with his katana. It's just like, in one panel, he'll be pulling it out. And then in the next, they'll have kind of already made the cut. I think it does a great job of conveying, like, that's how fast he is.
That's really cool. That's a difficult thing to do in comics or manga anyway. Because usually they have to resort to, like, speed lines or something like that, don't they? Oh, you know, when they have when they have, like, the after-image thing that they show.
Yeah, where you kind of see the sort of after-image making the cut.
Yeah.
But no, this is a really cool way of doing it. Especially when it's, like, some guy drawing a gun, then you see he got, like, pulling the sword out, and then there's just, like, an arm flying through the air.
That sounds really cool. I'm going to have to read this. This sounds pretty awesome, I've got to be honest.
It is. I like it a lot. I will say there's a couple of kind of problematic elements that I think come with the genre.
Mm.
So, first of all, I know it does refer to the Native Americans as Indians, which I know is kind of a sort of iffy term, but I think first of all, it's trying to be like more accurate to the time when it's set.
Yeah.
And also, I assume, Jiro Taniguchi being Japanese, there's not as much of a cultural thing there.
If you think about when these manga first came out, because I don't think they've gone through the process of sanitizing them to a degree. Most of Jiro Taniguchi's work was from the 80s and 90s. So...
Ah, right, okay.
It was.
Yeah, I assumed this was just a more modern thing.
No, most of his work was from the 80s and 90s. He did some work during the noughties and the 2010s. And he only really did like four manga during the 2010s. And he did almost twice that during the 2000s. But most of it was from the 80s and 90s. And so a lot of the language is, it's what was acceptable at the time, especially the translated version.
Yeah, I think it's... In that case, yeah, I don't think I can understand that because I think it's probably more important to kind of maintain how it is than to say, oh, this is a term we don't really use that much anymore, so we'll have to change it up.
Yeah. It's one of those quandaries because you don't want people to be offended in the modern era, but there is a need to preserve how things were depicted in the past so that you remember that this used to be a thing, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely better to be able to have this conversation about, you know, why we don't use that kind of word anymore.
Yeah.
Rather than just kind of trying to erase it from history.
Exactly. Do you remember when the Tintin or Asterix comic that they wanted to get rid of? Asterix in the Congo, was it? Or Tintin in the Congo? I can't remember.
Oh, Tintin, yeah. We even read that in school.
Yeah. But that's a...
I think I still have a copy of it somewhere in my house.
It's exactly what you said. That's something that promotes that debate, you know, that discussion. That, look, this was how bad it was that it was even depicted in comics like this, okay? This was the norm. It's not acceptable anymore, but this is how things used to be. You know, I think it's important to preserve things like that as they are, just for the purpose of teaching, if nothing else.
Yeah, exactly. We've gone all highbrow.
Well, we've had a day to think about it.
That's true. And the other thing I was going to say is that, kind of perhaps inevitably, being what genre it's based in, and I guess now the time it was written, there's not exactly an overflowing amount of strong female characters, shall we say.
Okay. That makes sense, actually.
Yeah, which, I mean, is always... I guess I'd maybe put this in one of those things where it's not, maybe not necessarily the fact that this story doesn't have them, and you can kind of, you can excuse it in this case of going, well, maybe at that time there wasn't really that many opportunities for women, but then it becomes a problem in like the larger context of there being a general dearth of like good female role models in fiction.
Yeah.
Obviously, I guess it's probably not a dearth, but still not as many as there should be.
Yeah.
Two highbrow points in a row. This is what early morning four panel gets you.
Well, not just early morning four panel. Early morning four panel where we're talking about a Jiro Taniguchi manga. Because don't forget, some of the stuff that he's done. What was it? A Zoo in Winter? Ferrari? Which is that one about the guy walking around making maps?
Oh, he's that guy.
Yes. The Ice Wanderer, which was the one where it had the big white moose on the cover.
Yes. Actually, you know, that makes sense now, because thinking about when you've kind of shown me the covers for those ones, it's a very similar art style.
Yeah.
And he does have a very distinctive style. Like, it's, you can tell it takes a lot of influence for, like, Western comics as well.
Yep.
Yeah, Skyhawk was real good.
Awesome.
And it'll make
awesome.
You want to shake your fist and go, white people.
I'm not saying anything.
I think, well, if you want to say something, you should maybe say our goodbyes, because we're at the end of the show.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are.
And it only took us, like, an extra 8 hours.
Yes. Well, more than that, wasn't it? But anyway, as Andrew said, we are at the end of the show, so we're going to leave you. But if you want to catch any of our previous episodes, you'll find them all on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, or you can listen to them on YouTube, on whichever podcast provider you choose, Audio Boom, Apple Podcasts, Acast, Deezer, Spotify, whatever you want to listen to us through. And if you're listening through anything like that, leave us a rating, leave us a review, leave us a comment, let us know what you think. Also on our website, you'll find all of our other shows on our network and reviews and video game stuff and various other things. So have a look, have an explore. There's lots there. Until next time, I've been Rob.
And I've been Andrew.
And we will see you all later.
Thanks for listening.